It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As Texas Republicans work to redraw their congressional maps to gain more seats in the U.S. House and protect their majority in Congress, other states around the country are considering whether they too should revisit their district boundaries ahead of next year's midterm elections.
Democrats in California and New York are weighing how to respond if Texas lawmakers finalize a new map. Here in Wisconsin, two lawsuits filed in Dane County Court aim to overturn the state's congressional map.
And in Texas, dozens of state Democratic lawmakers left the state in an attempt to block a vote on congressional maps. The leader of the walkout, Democratic State Representative Gene Wu, spoke with NPR's Morning Edition on Friday.
The real danger of this, if this spreads, if this goes on, if blue states do this, if red states do this, that is the end of our democracy, because once people stop listening to us and they can win without doing what the people want, it's game over.
To dig into this political moment of rare mid-decade redistricting and the implications on democracy, we turn to UW-Madison political science professor Barry Burden, director of its Elections Research Center. Barry, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Well, starting here in Wisconsin, we know that the group Wisconsin Business Leaders for Democracy filed a lawsuit claiming the state's House districts are an anti-competitive gerrymander. And also last month, the Elias Law Group filed a similar suit saying the state's congressional map is a partisan gerrymander, that it unfairly benefits Republicans. What is the status of these challenges in light of what's happening in Texas's statehouse?
Well, the challenges are pending. We're waiting to see what the court does with them. They're really a response to efforts to go directly to the Supreme Court over the last year or two. But the state Supreme Court has been very clear. They don't want to take these cases immediately. They want them to work through the court system. So these two groups have started in Dane County Court. It's unclear whether the court will take those up, and they could work their way through the legal process in time for the 2026 midterms, which really get underway with primaries. And those are in the summer. So candidates need to know where the districts are, where they live, and where they can file by probably late spring.
Time is running out, is what you're saying. To file
absolutely,
a
that's true. Yeah, that's true in Wisconsin, but also in these other states. Some of them have even earlier primaries. Texas's primary happens in the spring, so they're moving very quickly to try to get ahead of that deadline. It's always possible, I suppose, that a court could push back the primary or push back filing deadlines if there's some ongoing litigation about districts. That has happened in some states before. So what Texas and other states and maybe Wisconsin is doing is really going to upend a lot of aspects of the election process.
Well, turning our eye to Texas, the FBI saying it would aid Texas officials in tracking down dozens of these Democratic lawmakers who fled the state to stall this vote on Republicans' redistricting plans. What do you make of these actions by Democrats to leave the state and deny Republicans a quorum?
Well, I think we're in uncharted territory in terms of the hardball politics that are now being applied. To even consider doing a redistricting in the middle of the decade when a state isn't required to because of a lawsuit or some other problem is really a new level of partisan politics. It was made possible by a Supreme Court case back in 2019 out of North Carolina when the U.S. Supreme Court said essentially the courts have nothing to do with this. This is just partisanship. Democrats against Republicans, and they're permitted to do this. It's nothing unconstitutional. So Texas is taking advantage of that, but it's really escalated now that Governor Abbott has, commissioned the FBI. I'm not sure what federal crime has been committed to warrant their involvement. The salaries of the Democratic lawmakers are being withheld. They have traveled to places like Illinois and California and are doing a lot of media. So it's become quite a circus in Texas.
And then we saw on Friday the Attorney General Ken Paxton, trying to declare Democratic held seats vacant as these lawmakers have left the state. You know, is there any authority to be able to do such a thing?
It doesn't look like it, but again, we're in a territory that we've not been in before. This is a little reminiscent of when Democratic lawmakers in Wisconsin fled the state back in 2011 over the Act 10 debate. And there were, there was a lot of imagination going on among Republican leaders about how to get those Democrats back, whether they could be fined, whether they might be removed from their seats. Texas, I think, is being more aggressive than that. And this is really over just a partisan matter, not over the, you know, a deeper piece of legislation. So unclear when it will end. Governor Abbott says he is willing to play this game maybe for years, calling special session after special session to try to force Democrats to come back to the state.
So Texas state lawmakers are considering this new congressional map ahead of the midterms that would add roughly 5 Republican advantaged districts to the House race. What might happen if Texas Republicans succeed in adding 5 GOP seats to the U.S. House?
Well, just in the way of context, the 2026 midterms are coming up in a little over a year. Republicans have a slight majority in the House of Representatives. It's 219 seats for them, 212 for the Democrats. So Democrats only need to flip 4 seats in the midterm to gain control of the House, and that would really upend much of the Trump agenda, which works its way through the House. A shift of 5 seats in Texas would add 5 to the Republicans and take 5 away from the Democrats. So it would be a net swing of 10 seats in the direction of the Republicans. That's not enough to guarantee them they hold the majority in the House, but it would give them some insurance going into what's likely to be a rocky midterm election for them, just given the party of the president. Then the president's party tends to suffer in midterm elections. So it's a way to sort of shore up the possibilities in the midterm if they can eke out some additional seats in places like Missouri or Ohio or other states they're looking at. It might let them, you know, survive a tie against their party next year.
Barry Burden is with us, UW-Madison political science professor, director of the Elections Research Center, as we look at the moves for redistricting around America, especially in Texas. Barry, President Trump said he wants the next census to exclude non-citizens. As we look at ahead here, how could that affect redistricting? What are the implications?
Yeah, Trump's actually said 2 things in the last week. One is that he wants the census not to count non-citizens. The other is that he wants to do a census now, immediately, not wait until 2030, which is the normal 10-year timeline required by the U.S. Constitution. This would be a kind of quickie census. It would not be, I think, the official grand effort that we are all familiar with every 10 years. Mm-hmm. That's a really complicated process. There's planning already underway for 2030. So this would be a quickie that I think would try to collect some data, potentially for purposes of redistricting. I can't see how this would be done in time for the 2026 redistricting efforts, but it fits with a general message and concern from Republicans that there are voters who are not eligible, who are participating in elections, that's skewing results. And if they could make these corrections, it would both be a good thing in their view and would help their party.
How often do states redraw their congressional maps in non-census years, mid-decade?
Unless there is a lawsuit that orders the state to redraw the districts because they have violated the Constitution or some statute, it's not done. Hmm. This is a process that's done every 10 years following the census. Those districts are essentially locked in decade to decade. So Texas jumping out in the middle of the decade to try to draw districts in a kind of rapid fashion, just to save themselves next year, is really unusual. And the secondary idea of doing a census of some kind is really brand new.
And the domino effect here, California Governor Gavin Newsom now calling for his state to redraw its congressional districts in a way that favors Democrats. Can you talk about the other effects of what Texas is doing and how that might affect other parts of the country, maybe even Wisconsin?
Yeah, Democrats are really struggling with a response. Some Democrats have decided to fight fire with fire and draw districts in their blue states as much as they can to counteract the advantage Republicans may get in Texas. Some Democrats have said, no, they want to stick to principle and rely on nonpartisan or bipartisan commissions like the one in California. But it does look like Newsom and other Democrats have decided to override the commission that's used in California, at least on a temporary basis, only if the Texas plan goes through, as a way to counterbalance it. Some other Democratic governors in places like Illinois and New York are also thinking about it. They face more serious legal impediments. I think in New York, it would be very difficult to do. Illinois is already pretty skewed towards the Democrats. It'd be hard for them to get many more districts there. Wisconsin has a different kind of process going on. It's not going to be Democrats trying to redraw districts through a legislative process. It might be courts ordering that districts have to be redrawn. but there's not really a lot to be gained. The state only has 8 districts. It's currently a balance of 6 Republicans, 2 Democrats. It is possible in really favorable conditions, Democrats could pick up a seat or two here as a result of a court order.
So, you know, some Democrats are voicing caution about, you know, abandoning nonpartisan redistricting and calling this a dummy mander where political winds change and you spread your voters too thin in districts. Is there any chance of that happening in Texas?
The Texas Republicans look like they have produced a pretty sound map that would give them an additional 4 or 5 seats. And those would be, I think, well protected, even in difficult years when Republicans' vote share may drop a little bit. And that's different from what Texas experienced after the 2020 census when they drew a pretty aggressive map, but went a little too far and didn't get as much as they hoped in terms of seats based on the vote they were earning. But I think this map is done in a more strategic way, really looking at urban areas with large Hispanic populations to try to add some GOP seats. I think it will be effective if it's adopted.
Could there be a national solution to this redistricting arms race that we seem to be in our final moments together?
Well, the Democrats had floated a proposal over the last couple of years to create redistricting commissions in every state. This would be part of federal election legislation. Again, that's part of the tension Democrats are now feeling about whether to stick with those ideas or fight fire with fire. Republicans were really opposed to the idea from the outset. So it seems not impossible, but difficult for an agreement like that to come to fruition.
Barry, thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with you. Thanks.
Barry Burden is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. We've been talking about efforts around the country to redraw state congressional maps ahead of the 2026 midterm elections and the potential implications in a deeply divided and polarized country.
Coming up, find out why wildfire smoke has hit Wisconsin hard this year and what it means for our health.
It very much is weather dependent on whether or not, you know, that wildfire smoke reaches us, and then also whether or not it actually reaches the ground.
That's next here on Wisconsin Today.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Wisconsin has been under a haze of smoke this summer as wildfires blaze in Canada.
The smoke is considered unhealthy to breathe, and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources has issued several air quality alerts this summer on days when the air is in the red zone, which is considered unhealthy for everyone.
Last week, 7 of the 10 places with the worst air quality in the country were counties in Wisconsin, including Waukesha and Jefferson counties.
That's according to data from Air Now, a program that partners with state, local, and tribal agencies to track the air quality index around the country.
Craig Zarnecki is Air Management Outreach Coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Craig, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Well, we had record poor air quality 2 years ago, summer 2023. A lot of wildfire smoke coming into Wisconsin. Felt it affecting our lives. And I, and maybe other people, thought, okay, this is a fluke, a one-off maybe. Well, now here we are again this summer with a lot of wildfire smoke. How do we know, do we know if this is, you know, a thing, a new normal for Wisconsin?
Yeah, it certainly seems that way based off, you know, the last couple years. We are in the midst of the second worst wildfire season on record for Canada, behind only that 2023 season. The Canadian Interagency Forest Fire Center says there's about 750 or so active fires right now. Those are mainly across Manitoba and Saskatchewan. That's already burned about 16 million acres of land, which is roughly the size of West Virginia. We've certainly been feeling the impacts of those large fires here kind of throughout the summer.
What determines if a Canadian wildfire out west It's what determines if that smoke ends up here in Wisconsin, because it's not a sure thing, right?
That's true. It very much is weather dependent. So it really depends on weather systems and patterns. Once that wildfire smoke is separated from fires, you know, it raises up high into the atmosphere, and then those smoke plumes can be transported long distances by high and low pressure systems. And that is pretty much what we saw last week. There was a very slow moving high pressure system that kind of started last Tuesday, and then it just kind of sat there and hung out kind of over the upper Midwest through much of the week. And we're finally seeing some improvements today. But yeah, very much weather system dependent on whether or not, you know, that wildfire smoke reaches us, and then also whether or not it actually reaches the ground.
Now, looking at these Canadian wildfires for a moment, we've had a couple of members of Congress from Wisconsin sign on to letters, now a state lawmaker saying, hey, Canada, do a better job managing your wildfires. As you understand it, is this a Canadian wildfire management problem, or are there more systemic things going on that are making these big wildfires more likely?
Yeah, I think there's definitely a number of different factors at play here. Wildfire management may play a role, but there are also, you know, a number of other factors that are in play here. Traditionally, you know, wildfire smoke has affected Wisconsin more often in the late summer, but in recent years, that's been happening, you know, earlier, like in springtime, for example. You know, Canada's had less precipitation. They've had shorter winters, not as much snowpack. Warmer seasons, you know, this has all contributed to these really ideal conditions for these wildfires to start. And then once they start, everything is so dry, they're able to spread really quickly. And then on top of that, a lot of these fires are in very remote, very difficult to reach places as well. So they're difficult to put out too. So yeah, long list of reasons why we're feeling these impacts, and they all kind of, yeah, working together to create these impacts that we're feeling this summer.
Let's bring it home to Wisconsin now. What goes into monitoring our air quality around the state?
Yeah, sure thing. So the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, we have 18 PM2.5 monitors across the state. PM2.5 is the main pollutant of concern when we're talking about wildfire smoke. So our network uses very advanced monitoring technology. These monitors, what they're able to do is measure the amount of energy scattered by these particulates through a little stream of air. And then from there, algorithms take over and produce a measured concentration for us. And we're able to take that number, you know, and make it and turn it into a more digestible, easy to understand number, you know, which is the AQI or Air Quality Index. So that's what we use to help convey pollutant concentrations. So we have our air quality monitors, and then on top of that, we do also have air quality forecasters on staff who are looking at different modeling products. They're looking at satellite data and imagery, talking with other forecasters in the upper Midwest to kind of assess, you know, make a forecast, and then ultimately determine whether or not we would issue an advisory. And typically that threshold, when we would issue an advisory, is when that air quality index is expected to reach and then stay at that orange, unhealthy for sensitive groups level for at least 4 hours. So that's kind of the criteria that we use.
We got a question from a listener named Carol who emailed, in Marinette, the smoke has been thick for about the last week. We watch air quality measures on our phone weather apps when planning our day. We have found, however, the numbers vary greatly with different sources. My husband's app consistently rates the air quality as substantially worse than my app does, and other sources also vary. Why is there no consistency, even though we're in the same place? Craig, what do we know about different sources of that air quality information?
So regarding discrepancies that people may see in air quality values reported from different sources, different sites may use different algorithms that convert raw air pollution data into a number that we can all understand. That the DNR, we use, we display the AQI based on pollutant concentrations that are collected from our regulatory monitors, and then we use an algorithm that's defined within the Clean Air Act that we have to use. And that's the data that people would see. This is the same data if you're looking at EPA's Air Now maps, the EPA Air Now map or the EPA Air Now fire and smoke map. Those use that same data. Otherwise, there are other platforms out there that may use different algorithms that may not be the standard that we have to use for our regulatory monitors. So there are some variances there depending on what sites you're looking at. But really, you know, if you're looking at multiple sources and you're seeing different numbers, the most reliable are going to be the EPA Air Now or the DNR figures.
Back to your data, Craig, how do you communicate to the public? And I understand you're finding more and more ways to get that information out there.
Certainly. So when we do decide to issue an advisory, we immediately send a notification to the National Weather Service. And then very similar to how they would announce maybe a severe thunderstorm warning or something like that, you know, they're able to get that air quality advisory notice out as well. We do also post the advisory to our air quality monitoring map page. We have an email and text service. People can sign up to receive email or text notifications as soon as an advisory is issued, so they'd get that information right away. And then starting in 2023, we also started posting advisory information on the Nextdoor app to affected counties as well. And then in addition to that, we also work closely with the Department of Health and the Department of Public Instruction. We have an email list that we send out to our contacts there, you know, letting them know that an advisory is coming so they can help kind of prepare for those situations.
Often when we look at these advisories, if we're in the, you know, the middle levels of wildfire smoke, there might be something about, you know, people in sensitive groups should take precautions. Who are we talking to?
Yeah, so people in sensitive groups are going to be anyone with any kind of upper respiratory issues or heart or lung issues, people with asthma, and then children, the elderly, those who are pregnant, and then people who spend a lot of time outdoors working, for example. So those are going to be people in sensitive groups, and they're going to be kind of the most prone to feeling the effects of wildfire smoke. That's typically why we issue advisories once we hit that orange unhealthy for sensitive groups level.
And as we wrap up, what are our health worries about exposure to high levels of this particular particulate, the PM2.5?
Yeah, so these can cause a number of different health issues, a lot of upper respiratory problems. These PM2.5 particles are very small and can actually get into your bloodstream. But then symptoms, you know, eye and respiratory tract irritation, coughing, wheezing, difficulty breathing. And then, like I said, it can increase the risk of asthma attacks, long-term exposure. You know, can increase your risks of heart and cardiovascular issues. So yeah, a long list of health impacts. And I know the CDC said in 2023, when we had all the wildfire smoke impacts then, asthma-associated ER visits jumped about 20%. So there is a correlation there between, you know, asthma attacks and wildfire smoke for sure.
Craig, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
That's Craig Czarnecki, Air Management Outreach Coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. We're talking about how wildfire smoke from Canada is affecting Wisconsin's air quality this summer. Now we turn to a researcher in Colorado, where wildfires have been affecting air quality for a bunch of years. Colleen Reed is Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Colorado Boulder. Her current research looks at how wildfire smoke affects air quality and the health of children in schools and at home. Colleen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, before we get into the science, I want to hear a firsthand report. You're there in Colorado. I understand you've had a lot more smoke impacts than we have in Wisconsin. How have those, especially summers, impacted day-to-day life for you, family, and friends and students in Colorado?
Yeah, I mean, right now we're getting a little bit of impact from the Canadian fires, but we've had not as bad smoke this summer as you've had in Wisconsin, but we're used to it. I think that it's something that Coloradans have been used to checking the air quality index for quite a while, but for us, it's periodic. We have fires that occur nearby where we'll have, you know, smoke local and we can actually have the risk of evacuations. But we also get long range transport from often when the Pacific Northwest is on fire. That's where we get our smoke from. That's from a long distance away.
Some of your research is focused on the Marshall Fire of 2021, one of the most destructive wildfires in Colorado's history. What have you learned about the impact of air pollution from studying that particular fire?
That particular fire was very devastating because it happened in my community and people I know were affected. But it was also, as you said, highly destructive. So over 1,000 structures were burned within a matter of about 8 hours. And there were so many things that were really interesting about that fire. I'm used to studying fires that are predominantly burning vegetation. And what was predominantly burned in that fire was houses. It started in grasslands. So it started in wildlands, but then it spread really quickly into suburban areas just south of Boulder, which is where I'm located. And most of what burned once it caught fire to homes were other homes and vehicles. And previous research by others had found that that can cause emissions that are more toxic than when vegetation is burned. There's lots more metals, and some of the gases that are created by the combustion can be different concentrations of different toxic gases. And then another thing that I want to, and I think we're getting more and more of these wildland urban interface fires where it starts in wildlands, but soon also consumes lots of human-made materials, such as the Los Angeles fires that happened earlier this year, as well as, you know, the Lahaina fire in Hawaii. There's unfortunately more and more of these that are happening. But what we had for air quality impacts were more for the people whose homes were not destroyed by the fire, but were, you know, in the same community. They had very high winds. We had 100-mile-per-hour gusts that day that were blowing smoke into their homes through every crevice. They had ash everywhere. They had smoke that was absorbed into all porous materials in their homes, which through this process I learned includes not just, you know, carpets and couches, but also drywall is porous. And so all of those gases got absorbed into the home. And the cleaning process for that was really hard because there was really no research that we could basically, because this happened right by a university, all of us who study that here were contacted about what people should do. And we were surprised that we couldn't find much research on this sort of smoke damaged homes. And so we went in to try and investigate that more.
Here's something I wonder about. Now, let's just take wildfire smoke. Still a health concern, as we're hearing from Craig, can trigger things like asthma attacks or other upper respiratory condition. Do we know about long-term impacts, though, if people are repeatedly exposed over, you know, months of a summer or a year to year? Is this could have a cumulative long-term impact?
That is such a good question. And we're starting to be able to answer that. There's been a few more recent studies that have been looking at long-term exposure to wildfire smoke and linking it to a variety of health impacts, such as, you know, increased mortality or cardiovascular events. The challenge with the long-term studies that I think is happening, and it's a big discussion among researchers who study wildfire smoke and health, is that often long-term air pollution epidemiology studies will look at the annual average of PM2.5 and link it to health outcomes, you know, following people up over, you know, decades to see what the long-term impact of exposure to PM2.5 is. The challenge with wildfire smoke is it's different from other pollutants. So we have PM2.5 from anything that combusts. So we have all sorts of other sources of PM2.5, like vehicle emissions or industrial emissions. Those are pretty constant over time versus wildfire smoke is really episodic. So you could have in one place, you're getting the same annual average for one really bad wildfire over a 2-week period of time, or you could have it for a lot of smaller wildfires at lower concentrations over a year. And so researchers are now asking, is there something different about, you know, these really high concentration air pollution events versus lots of smaller events? And we don't have the answers to that at this point in time.
It sounds like there's a lot we don't know yet, and the urgency of knowing it seems to go up from year to year. Are you hoping to see more of this kind of research into the health impacts of wildfire smoke?
I am. I also think, though, that we do have a lot of evidence from other sources of PM2.5. Like, we know that it's not good for your health. And so we can try to do things to protect people's health now while we wait for that evidence to come out. And so I want to see more studies into ways that we can protect people's health now. For example, one of the reasons that I'm doing the study that you mentioned about schools is because there was this uncertainty about whether schools should stay open during wildfire smoke events, because we don't know if schools or homes are actually safer indoor air quality for students. And so we wanted to gather that data because really there was no data on it. And so trying to figure out things like that, because if we can make schools clean air spaces for all kids to have at least for 7 hours a day, I think that that's a huge step towards protecting children from this exposure. And so I think it's that kind of research that I'm hoping to see, so that even while we wait for more information about long-term health impacts, we can still protect people's health now.
Colleen, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Colleen Reed, Associate Professor of Geography at the University of Colorado Boulder, telling us about her research on the health impacts of wildfire smoke. Earlier, we heard from Craig Czarnecki, Air Management Outreach Coordinator at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources.
Schlitz beer in Milwaukee was once the top-selling brand in the country. We'll hear the story of the marketing scandal and federal charges that led to its downfall.
With some skunky beer and some horrible advertising, that was sort of the trinity that really brought down a billion-dollar company in a matter of 5-6 years.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Might be hard to believe in the age of artisan microbreweries, but Schlitz, the beer that made Milwaukee famous, once dominated the market.
So let's get together with a glass of Schlitz, that great light beer from Schlitz.
With just a kiss of the hops, Schlitz became the top-selling beer in the country in the late 1940s.
Real gusto in a great light.
The beer that made Milwaukee famous simply because it tastes so good.
But that Milwaukee institution came crashing down in the 1970s after a heated market war with Budweiser, a questionable ad campaign, and a marketing corruption scandal that led to federal prosecution.
The authors of a new Esquire magazine article chronicle that story, centering around Bob Martin, a key player in the Schlitz marketing campaigns that led to its downfall.
David Bourgeois is a Brooklyn-based writer who has written about film, music, and politics, and Michael Lander is an award-winning writer and director. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
And David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
David, what made the two of you want to tell this story about the downfall of Schlitz beer?
Well, I first learned of Bob Martin. I first met Bob Martin as a kid. He was actually good friends with my parents. And as a kid, as kind of a teenager, I first learned about something called the house that Schlitz built, which my parents and Bob Martin would joke about. And that happened at a Christmas party one year when I was kind of relegated to the bartender role. And I kept overhearing my parents and Bob laugh about the house that Schlitz built. So as a teenager, I never really kind of thought much more about that. But then as I became a writer, moved to New York, still kind of wondered what all of that was about. Because at the time, Bob was also in the news. He had sued Schlitz. So he was one of my parents' friends who was just in the news. So I kind of knew about him. So as I got older, I kind of thought it was an interesting story and I didn't really know much about it. And I started to just do a little digging, reached out to Bob, who was retired and living in Kansas City at the time. Bob was only too happy to talk about himself and talk about his days at Schlitz. So I flew to Kansas City, stayed with him for a couple nights, chatted with him, and then kind of reached out to Michael because I was thinking at least that this could be a film. And Michael, who's in the film industry, once I told Michael the whole story, he was kind of smitten and was interested in kind of helping it progress. So that's kind of how the story kind of was, you know, birthed.
And we'll meet Bob Martin and learn more about him in a bit. But Michael, can you first set the stage for us? Mid-20th century, I think you guys use the phrase Milwaukee being something like the Silicon Valley of the beer industry. Can you talk about that scene and why beer was such a dominant force?
Well, I'm a screenwriter. I'm a writer-director. So I always sort of look at everything through that lens. And when he brought it to me, I was like, this looks like the cast of Anchorman starring in Goodfellas in Milwaukee in the late 1970s. With a lot of heart, there's a lot going on in the background. But Milwaukee, Dave can probably speak to the state of Milwaukee in the 70s better than I can. But it really was a central hub. There were four major breweries. You could have, you could go to work at one of those breweries and have a really nice working class life. You could raise a family and have kids and a house and have a, you know, eke out a really nice sort of middle class life for yourself. And it was a very attractive place to try to go and work. And Bob was one of those guys who right out of college was like, hell yeah, I'm going to go work at one of the, you know, the second largest brewery in the world, a multi-billion-dollar company at the time. They were only second to Anheuser-Busch. And 1957 is when Budweiser passed Schlitz as being the number one beer manufacturer in the world. So it was a hotbed place to work. It was super cool. There was even a television show in the 70s called Laverne and Shirley that took place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And they worked in a brewery called Schatz. Right? Am I getting that right? Is it Schatz or
Schatz Brewery?
Schatz Brewery. Believe, yeah. That's right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And David, we don't like Schlitz. It got resurrected recently, but it was a phantom beer for a long time. And now it's just kind of a, you know, part of a retro beer thing now. This was a big deal. It was a huge company, right? As it was number one and then number two for a while, which is part of what makes this story amazing. Why this a huge company went away. Talk about the heyday of Schlitz a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 1950s, Schlitz was, you know, they were at that point, they were the number one beer. They certainly ping ponged back and forth between Schlitz and Anheuser-Busch. But, you know, Schlitz, their revenue in the 50s, they had years where they were making billions in revenue. I mean, you know, billions with a B, and for a family run brewery, which it was, the Eline family ran it for decades. That is a lot of money. And it was just an economic juggernaut. And then, you know, as the 50s kind of turned into the 60s, things got a little tighter. By the 70s, Schlitz was kind of a little bit struggling. There were issues with some of the actual quality of the beer. And as we talk about in our article, there was some disastrous ad campaigns as well. So, you know, kind of looking at Schlitz from the 50s on through the 70s, and then it was, you know, sold off for parts in the early 80s. It brought in so much money, and it was a real economic engine for the, obviously not just the family that owned it, but for the city as well. It, you know, employed thousands of people. Of course, trying to take over the number one spot from Anheuser-Busch was certainly what Schlitz was attempting to do with these accounts of influence, which were trying, you know, Schlitz was trying to get into stadiums and airports and all of that stuff. So it was a it was a time where in the early 50s where Schlitz was doing well, but they were also starting to lose some of their market share. And it was kind of a pretty vitriolic war between Anheuser-Busch and Schlitz.
And David, your main character in this story, Bob Martin, is very aggressive in his marketing. Can you talk about the sort of things that they were doing at Schlitz to try to make sure that everything from that corner bar to the baseball stadium had their beer and only their beer?
Yeah, well, there, you know, part of the SEC indictments, most of them were misdemeanors. There are, you know, 747 counts, but some of the things that Bob Martin was spearheading were, as we mentioned in our article, were kind of comical. I mean, to the point of just, you know, very, very small infractions, such as going into local bars and kind of walking into a bar and saying, oh, you know, looks like your floor could use to, you know, possibly you could use a new floor. Well, we can kind of take care of that. We at Schlitz can kind of take care of that as long as you ensure that, you know, of the, let's say, six taps, Schlitz is in five of the six, or, you know, so they would go into local bars, which of course is kind of small potatoes, but they also, as I mentioned, were kind of going for these accounts of influence, which were like O'Hare Airport in the 60s. It was the largest draft beer account in the nation. So they kind of saw an entryway there once Budweiser had a strike. So they would do things like...
Which Bob had insider information on.
Yes.
Bob had Bob had. I think Bob went to college with a guy who was working there at Budweiser and actually called Bob and tipped him off that it was going to happen.
Yeah.
Total insider trading.
Yeah. And there were also, you know, there were also things like, for example, Schlitz in the early 70s. Schlitz paid money to the the Conrad Hilton Hotel. They paid them about $10,000. For the purported rental of a hotel suite for a cocktail party, right? That cocktail party never happened. So there were ways that Schlitz would kind of do end runs around, you know, the law to ensure that Schlitz got prominent placement in hotels and all of this stuff. So they kind of ran a couple different sets of books. They ran a lot of money through advertising agencies that never did any advertising. It was really all of a way to get money back to venues, to, you know, to bars, to ballparks, to train stations, train hubs, you name it. And they would have to come up with fairly inventive ways of moving money around. So that, you know, there's instance after instance of it. Some of them, as we mentioned, are comical. Some of them required a lot of people just making kind of shell companies in order to kind of get the money back to the venue. So it was a fairly complicated procedure.
And Michael Schlitz may have thought of this as aggressive marketing. Well, hold on. Federal investigators thought of this as kickbacks and bribes. Speaking of movie moments, you tell the story in your piece about Schlitz saying effectively, yeah, come on in. We've got nothing to hide. Go through our offices. No problem. And then what happened?
Steven Kravitz is what happened. Steven Kravitz, 25 years old, I believe, at the time, third year Harvard graduate, ends up going into the offices of Schlitz. And he went in mid-late morning. And they told him that Schlitz was absolutely confident they had nothing to hide. Every 2 years, they had a two-year document policy where basically they kept no document older than 2 years. So clearly, Schlitz had thought they had gone through and scrubbed the entire office. And there's Steven Kravitz, 25 years old, with his glasses, says, hey, I can go anywhere. And they're like, yeah, you can go anywhere. So he walks into one of the offices. It's Gustafson, right, Dave?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So he walks into Gustafson's office, who was like a big sales guy, and opens, sits his desk, opens a drawer, And there is essentially the second set of books, the ledgers, the correspondences with everyone. These guys were incredibly hubristic about their sort of sales conquests. They kept carbon copies. So, you know, in the old days before email and all that, you had a carbon copy. You know, you had a blue copy, a yellow copy, a green copy. You would write on the top copy and it would, you know, push the ink all the way through, all the way down. And that's what he found. And it really became the cornerstone of the 747 count indictment that ended up going against Schlitz. And again, with, you know, some skunky beer and some horrible advertising that was sort of the trinity that really brought down a $1 billion company in a matter of 5-6 years.
We're talking about the downfall of Schlitz Brewing Company, once the most popular beer in the country. David Bourgeois and Michael Lander chronicled its downfall for Esquire magazine. You've both mentioned those ads. I want to give a listen to one of the Gusto ad campaign. Here it is.
Excuse me, champ. Great fight. Now, we'd like to take away your Schlitz and have you endorse our beer.
No. You want to take away my Gusto? Say, you tickle me. You want to take away my Schlitz, my Gusto? Well, I'm going to play Picasso and put you on the canvas.
David, I watched a bunch of ads from this series before I talked to you guys. This is one of the less violent ones. This one, the star is only going to beat you for questioning a Schlitz. Others will actually murder you
right
if you try to take this. This didn't go over well, apparently.
It was so disastrously bad that it is this ad campaign is literally taught in some marketing classes on exactly how not to market a product. and it's as the ad that you played is awesome, and it's just like kind of like head scratching. And I think there's another one of that series where there's like a guy out in the wilderness, and there's like a mountain lion.
His mountain lion will eat you. He'll sick his mountain lion on you, his cougar, if you take away his Schlitz.
Which is just like, if you kind of think about this, and the guy who kind of dreamed up these ads, Leo Burnett, who was, you know, an ad legend. Maybe he thought these were going to be kind of tongue in cheek, or maybe he thought these were going to be kind of funny. But in essence, what they did is they actually drove people away from the beer because they were kind of they were a little creepy and a little just like frightening. They actually weren't that funny. Certainly in retrospect, they're funny. But when you're kind of playing it at the time, people were like, what are these things? You know?
And we'll leave it there. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me.
And David, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. This was great.
That was David Bourgeois and Michael Lander. Their article about the fall of Milwaukee's Schlitz Brewing Company is in July's Esquire magazine. Hey, do you have memories, fond or otherwise, of the heyday of Schlitz beer or its downfall? Were you there working for the company? Are there old Schlitz signs passed down in your family? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org.
Wisconsin is host to many sporting events, some that fly under the radar.
And some fly over wakes. A shout out to Janesville, which hosted the Show Ski National Championships over the weekend with the storied ski team, the Rock Aqua Jays, representing Wisconsin with pride and claiming another national championship title.
Woohoo! And Madison United and the Wisconsin Rugby Complex in Cottage Grove for playing host to the USA Club Sevens National Championship. Dozens of men's and women's rugby teams from around the country battled it out over the weekend.
And congrats to Madison's summer collegiate softball team, the Madison Nightmares, that just won the Northwoods League Championship.
What sports team should we be talking about that doesn't often make it into the spotlight? Let us know the players who your community is rooting for and a team that is doing something special for Wisconsin.
Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call and leave a message or text us. The number is 888-642-0222.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Rochelle Wilson, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.